This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
I think for me, every time everybody talks about Africa and African diaspora, it really, really changed the narrative about the continent and the role the diaspora can play to make the continent a better place as well as the community where we live.
That was Almaz Nagash, founder of the African Diaspora Network and a new addition to President Biden's Advisory Council on African Diaspora Engagement. Details coming up. Also, the World Health Organization warns South Sudan is facing a health and hunger crisis, and the U.S. government could be shutting down this weekend. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The World Health Organization warns South Sudan is facing a health and hunger crisis that is set to get worse as the climate crisis kicks in. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
South Sudan has suffered from the overlapping effects of conflict, climate crisis, infectious diseases, and hunger for years. The United Nations reports 6.3 million South Sudanese are suffering from acute hunger, and more than 9 million of the country's population of 12 million depend on humanitarian assistance. As conditions continue to deteriorate, the World Health Organization reports 500,000 more people this year will need international aid. Among the most vulnerable are the children, who are suffering from the highest rate of severe malnutrition in the past 4 years. WHO warns many are likely to die without immediate medical attention. WHO incident manager for the Horn of Africa, Lisbeth Elbrecht, warns the situation will worsen with the onset of El Nino, a climate phenomenon that can cause excess rains and temperatures to rise.
Flooding and hunger and drought will increase hunger even further, but it's also very likely to increase the risk of mosquito-borne diseases, so especially malaria and dengue, and waterborne diseases.
She added that malaria is one of the five main causes of death in South Sudan. Speaking Friday from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, to reporters in Geneva, Elbrecht says she just left South Sudan. In the capital, Juba, and in Bentiu, the capital of Unity State, she says she visited stabilization centers where families bring severely malnourished children for medical treatment. While there, she says she saw doctors trying to resuscitate babies on life support. In one instance, she says she saw a baby pass away in her mother's arms.
I quote figures, I give you percentages, but that behind all these figures, there are these faces. And standing there as a bystander and watching this child die of hunger and of preventable diseases, even after doing medical humanitarian work for 25 years now, it does remain one of the most difficult things to do.
Elbrecht says all is not lost. Much can be done to protect people with relatively little. She acknowledges a lot of money will be needed to provide the aid so desperately needed by these millions of people. However, she adds, the returns are great, as feeding people and preventing and treating infectious diseases are highly cost-effective interventions. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Almaz Nagash was born and raised in the Horn of Africa nation, Eritrea. In 1987, she came to the United States as a foreign student. After she got her BA from the University of San Francisco and her MBA from Golden State University, she founded the African Diaspora Network, ADN, an organization with the mission of informing and engaging Africans in the diaspora. A few days ago, Mrs. Nagash was one of 12 members named to sit on President Biden's Advisory Council of African Diaspora Engagement in the United States. She starts out by talking to me about how she started her diaspora network, ADN.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for the opportunity. ADN was founded about 13 years ago, but I think the idea has been percolating in my head for many years. I am based in Silicon Valley, and for many years I've had the greatest opportunity to work with many top leaders, social entrepreneurs, business entrepreneurs, and everybody met very well. But whenever there was a discussion about Africa, I didn't see Africans at the table. I think that didn't sit well with me. So in 2010, I discussed this with someone I knew. He was running an online platform that focuses on social entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley. And I challenged the premise, why is everyone talking about Africa, but Africans are not on the platform? And I think he answered this to me in a question, and he said, what are you going to do about it? And I think that was just like, wow, he's right. Why am I complaining? Why can't I do something about it? And I went ahead and came up with an idea of what if, instead of asking people to invite us, what if we create a platform that we can invite Africans and friends of Africa? This matters to me, especially the latter. We Africans have a deep connection to the continent, but then there are friends of Africa who don't look like myself, who also love the continent and want to do some great things on the continent. I think that was the genesis of ADN. I had 15 people I brought together. These are my friends, Americans, Africans, and from all over the world. 15 of them we met at EMC. It's a company in Santa Clara. And I gave them my idea. Nobody said no, but then of course they said, no, this is great. Go ahead and make it happen. I think that's the beginning of taking a charge. And I think I felt comfortable that I could do this, but I wasn't alone in many ways. I've always believed that I have incredible support from my own family, my husband, my children, of course, friends and our community. They just came behind and in front and supported me in any way. And I think over the last 9 years, we accelerated the work we do.
You have been fostering direct collaboration with social entrepreneurs, innovators, and business leaders. And then out of the blues, there is a call from the White House, right? How were you informed that you were actually chosen to be in the Advisory Council on African Diaspora Engagement in the United States by President Biden?
So I think it's very humbling. I am grateful for the opportunity, and every such opportunity comes with a lot of responsibility, and I take it very seriously. But at the same time, I actually found out in July that I was one of the 12 people selected. However, I was told not to mention a word out of it until the president makes an announcement, which happened 2 days ago. And I never did. I didn't tell my family, didn't tell my board, didn't tell my team. So I kept it.
Now that you are a member of the President Biden's Advisory Council on African Diaspora Engagement in the United States, what are you obligated to do? What do you think you'll be contributing to this council?
Luckily, I don't have to do much because we're doing it. The very thing that the president is asking us to do, which if you look at the name of it, is African Diaspora Engagement Advisory Council. That is exactly what ADN does. So in so many ways, really, what we do is exactly what the president wants to do. And I think for me is to contribute, but also to engage, to engage the U.S. government at a much higher level in terms of what we're doing. We have a platform that the U.S. government has been using. We have been partners with the State Department, with USADF, with Prosper Africa, with USAID. ADN has been working with the government, just so you know, for the last 9 years. We have some amazing partnership and collaboration that we do. We take it to the next level. We then become a direct support to this idea. But what does it mean to the continent? I think for me, every time everybody talks about Africa and African diaspora, it really, really changed the narrative about the continent and the role the diasporans can play to make the continent a better place, as well as the community where we live.
That was Almaz Nagash, one of 12 members named to sit on President Biden's Advisory Council of African Diaspora Engagement in the United States. She spoke with me from the U.S. state of California. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. There is a possibility the United States government could be shutting down over the weekend. To explain what a government shutdown is all about, we have online VOA's Catherine Gibson. Welcome to Africa News Tonight, Catherine.
Good to be with you.
So go ahead, explain to us what a government shutdown is. Who is behind it?
Well, you would hear different stories from different political parties in the United States. Democrats blaming Republicans, Republicans blaming Democrats. But at the heart of this battle is that conservative members of the Republican Party are angry with their leadership, Speaker Kevin McCarthy. They believe he's not doing enough to cut government spending. And until he does that in legislation, they will not vote for any funding to continue the government being open past an October 1st deadline. So it really looks like headed into this weekend that we are indeed going to have a government shutdown.
So, Catherine, let's say the government shuts down. What are the repercussions, not only for the U.S., but for the world in large?
Well, they're pretty significant because government employees can't be paid, national parks shut down. All of the processes and functions of the U.S. government are put on hold. So everything from the U.S. State Department to passport processing to all of the daily things that federal employees do to carry out administration policy, all of those are put on hold while we wait to see if the government is funded.
So you're saying consular offices like embassies, slowing visa applications around the world?
That's right. So the U.S. government pares it down to what it calls essential operations, kind of a very bare bones team, the very smallest team that can just keep the basic functions operating. But really, the full actual activities of the U.S. government are put on hold.
So we have until Saturday midnight, I think. Is there any hope something might be resolved?
Well, that's certainly the hope here in the United States. And what it looks like is going to happen is that Speaker Kevin McCarthy will have to make a deal to get Democratic votes to pass what's called a short-term CR, a continuing resolution, that basically just buys U.S. lawmakers about 30 days, funding the government for those 30 days while they continue negotiations on funding priorities. Even now, though, that looks like that could be a tough sell. So it's going to be a very tense weekend here in Washington, D.C.
VOA's Catherine Gibson, thank you for your input.
You're so welcome.
New United Nations research shows an estimated 931 million tons of food, or 17% of total food available to consumers in 2019, went into the waste bins of households, retailers, restaurants, and other food services. Yet millions of people are food insecure. Reporter Mugume Davis Rawakaringi has more from Kampala, Uganda.
Food vendor Sulaiman Thambi sits under an umbrella to shelter from the scorching sun in a busy Karirwa market in a Kampala suburb. Ntambi says for the last 15 years, he's had to count losses because of changing weather patterns.
At times you get lost when it rains on our stuff because it gets rotten. As you see here, they are in open space. When it rains, it can get spoiled. We use those shelters, but it's not enough for us. Even sunshine also affects us.
Ntambi deals in fruits and vegetables such as oranges, tomatoes, passion fruits, cabbages and potatoes. With no adequate storage facilities at the market, Ntambi says he's had to dump some of his products or sell them away at throwaway prices. A new United Nations study says across the globe, millions of people are food insecure, while millions of tons of food are wasted every year. The report came out just before today's International Food Wastage Awareness Day, which aims to reduce food loss. Most food is wasted at households, markets, and retail outlets. Francis Ojulong, a father of four, estimates 30% of his family's food is wasted either at home or during the ride home on a border or motorcycle taxi.
We buy from the markets and send home. Since we don't have gardens here in town, even the borders themselves we give to carry it home. By the time it reaches, it is maybe remaining half the batch of matoke. Because they go only carrying on a border, it keeps on falling and so on. But even watermelon, by the time it reaches home, it's already broken. So you can't preserve it, you can't even keep for 2 days. So the one which is broken, you have to eat it immediately. So in most cases, we end up wasting just to eat to finish up, not to use it at the, as it's expected.
Matoke or plantain is Uganda's staple food, eaten raw or cooked. David Kabanda is executive director of the Center for Food and Adequate Living Rights, an organization that advocates for food safety and security. He says food waste and loss starts before and during harvesting.
During the time of harvest, someone may have, for example, a field of maize, and as they harvest, they leave food combs into the field. Or when they harvest beans, when they are hurrying out of the beans, a sizable, a number of kilograms is left in the field. Or when they start to sort out beans, and they only sort out those that are appealing to see, and the rest is thrown away.
He says rodents also eat some food in storage. Faith Nachigozi, who has one child, says it's unfortunate that some families dump food while their neighbors are starving.
Even if you're not related to someone, that person is your brother, that person is your sister, maybe in spirit. So it's better at least you give out the food instead of wasting it.
Kabanda says the government and NGOs should work together to educate citizens on better food practices. He also advises against impulse buying. The UN says about 821 million people go hungry worldwide and 3 billion are unable to afford a health diet. For VOA News, I am Gume, Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
VOA Africa is your trusted source for news, sports, entertainment, and music. Stay engaged with VOA Africa. We love to hear your voice. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message. Leave comments, requests, or greetings. We may play your message on VOA Africa. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. VOA Africa is always happy to hear your voice. The number again is the international code +1, then 202-258-3076.
In Namibia, a meeting of health experts recently announced the rollout of the HPV vaccine targeting girls between 9 and 14 years old. The vaccine is aimed at protecting women from HPV-related cancers and genital warts. Cervical cancer ranks as the second most frequent cancer among women in Namibia and is the third most frequent among women between the ages of 15 and 44 worldwide. Vitalio Anguilla reports from Windhoek in Namibia.
In Namibia, a meeting of health experts recently announced the rollout of HPV vaccine targeting girls between 9 and 14 years old. The vaccine is aimed at protecting women from HPV-related cancers and genital warts. Cervical cancer ranks as the second most frequent cancer among women in Namibia and is the most frequent among women between ages of 15 and 44 worldwide. Vitalio Angula reports from Windhoek, Namibia. Nearly all cervical cancers are linked to genital infection with HPV. The HPV vaccine is the first that directly addresses sexual and reproductive health. Although Namibia lags behind several other African countries in rolling out the HPV vaccine, health authorities see it as necessary to combat sexually transmitted infections, which are quite common. Speaking at the event, the acting executive at the Ministry of Health, Taimi Amambo, said the vaccinations for HPV will be more complex compared to the immunizations against rubella and tetanus, which are administered to infants. She explained how the decision came about.
The NITAG, which is the National Immunization Technical Advisory Group, was established in May last year, 2023, and it conducted the scientific evidence to recommendations process and provided a strong recommendation to the ministry on the motivation why we need to roll out and introduce HPV vaccine as part of our current EPI, expanded schedule, a program for immunization for the 9 to 14 years age group.
The vaccine is administered through an injection in the muscles of the arm or thigh. Women's health and social entrepreneur Neveline Amwenye says HPV vaccinations do not treat HPV but are rather a preventative tool in minimizing infection. She told VOA Africa that HPV is common in both males and females. Most people will contact HPV at least once in their lifetime, which the body can clear out, but can sometimes lead to precancer.
HPV vaccines can prevent infection with certain types of HPV, including types that are linked to HPV-related cancers, as well as types linked to anal and genital warts. Vaccines are approved for use in males and females. They can only be used to prevent HPV infection. They do not help treat an existing infection, which is important to note.
The First Lady of Namibia, Monica Genkos, who is also the president of the Organization of African First Ladies, has been mobilizing efforts across Africa for the introduction of HPV vaccines in adolescent girls. She says in Africa, cervical cancer is a major health concern for women, representing 20% of all cancers diagnosed among them and coming in only second to breast cancer.
Left with no choice but to do things differently. Reducing the number of women who die from cervical cancer has always been urgent. It makes no sense that the cervical cancer disease burden continues to increase while cervical cancer is probably the only truly preventable cancer. The scaling up of prevention for both HIV and HPV programs needs new and innovative approaches. There is the real risk of losing ground in gains made, but there is also the real opportunity in sustaining them.
Rwanda became the first country on the continent to introduce HPV vaccine in 2011 and has achieved a 98% vaccination rate through its school-based program. South Africa introduced the HPV vaccine in 2014, while it was introduced in Burkina Faso in April 2022. The vaccine was said to be introduced in Namibia but was delayed due to the COVID-19 pandemic. The country plans to roll it out early next year. For VOA Africa, I'm Vitalio Angula from Windhoek, Namibia.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Douglas Mpuga, and our engineer, Cedric Franklin, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Africa is your trusted source for news, sports, entertainment, and music. Stay engaged with VOA Africa. We love to hear your voice. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message. Leave comments, requests, or greetings. We may play your message on VOA Africa. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. The
VOA Africa is always happy to hear your voice. The number again is the international code +1, then 202-258.